internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
From The Guardian, this is Chips with Everything. I'm Lee Alexander, and this is the beginning of a series that we've been working hard on for a really, really long time now. There's been many, many long nights for a couple of months now.
I got up earlier than 6 a.m. for the first time in my life this morning to interview someone from Estonia for the series.
Wow, the only time I'm up at 6 a.m. is if I'm up till 6 a.m. This is our producer, the producer of Chips with Everything, the excellent Matt Shore.
Aww.
He's going to be helping me host our upcoming episodes. He's done a lot of the research on it as well. Hello, Matt.
Hey, I'm really excited for this because, I mean, even though I produce this show, and I guess I'm a technology reporter in a sense.
Yeah.
When it comes to so many aspects of tech and the tech industry, I'm absolutely clueless. But this series is about something that I'm actually quite the expert in, the internet.
And this is not just about the internet. It's actually about something really, really exciting that's come out of the United Nations recently. So on July 4th, 2016, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution that classified access to the internet as a fundamental, basic human right.
Okay, so let's actually walk through it. The resolution was introduced by the UN's Human Rights Council to the General Assembly, and that's where it was debated, right?
Right. And to start off, it's important to note that this resolution has been in the works for a really, really long time. Internet access becoming a human right was debated in the General Assembly March of 2015, June of 2014, also in 2013, 2012, and as far back as 2009. And all of these debates and arguments and questions and answers that were explored in those meetings led to this resolution that passed at the beginning of July this year. So it has been a long process, but it has finally passed. And it passed as an extension, if you will, of Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Exactly. And I have a copy of it in front of me right now. It's 4 pages long, single-sided, single-spaced. it says, Human Rights Council 32nd Session, Agenda Item 3, Promotion and Protection of All Human Rights, Civil, Political, Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, Including the Right to Development. And then in big, bold letters, it says, the promotion, protection, and enjoyment of human rights on the internet. And beyond that, to me, this resolution is not much than just words on a page.
Yeah, well, it does start to list all of these different points about how having access to the internet theoretically makes our lives better. One quote says, interconnectedness has great potential to accelerate human progress, to bridge the digital divide, and to develop knowledge societies. Another quote here, access to information on the internet facilitates vast opportunities for affordable and inclusive education globally.
So in theory, I suppose that all makes sense. I mean, someone of my IQ can understand it all. But it only really gets more complicated from there, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it IQ aside, it's pretty confusing. So that's why we talked to this guy.
Well, I'm a law professor at first. And for the last couple of years, I've been working as the special rapporteur on freedom of opinion and expression for the United Nations, which basically means I monitor free speech around the world. It's an appointment by the UN, the Human Rights Council, which is a part of the General Assembly and is really the central human rights body in the UN system, and they appointed me 2 years ago.
So that's David Kaye. He sat down with us in the studio the other week to kind of help us make sense of this new resolution and of the Article 19.
When we talk about Article 19, we're talking about either the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. It's the same basic language. The declaration was adopted in 1948 and the ICCPR in 1966. It provides, first, that everyone has the right to hold opinions without interference. It's not subject to any restriction. It then provides that everyone has the right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, through any media, including art, for example. And then it finally allows governments and recognizes that governments may impose restrictions only on that second part, the freedom of expression, but it can only do so where it's provided by law, where it's necessary and proportionate in order to achieve a specific objective. And Article 19 lists those legitimate objectives as rights or, to protect the rights or reputations of others, or public order, national security, public health, and morals. But that's it. There's no other ground on which you can restrict freedom of expression, according to Article 19.
So again, this resolution is now part of what David just described, Article 19.
Exactly. He is very clear, though, that at the core of the resolution is the idea that when access to the internet is blocked or cut off, we lose our ability to exercise so many of our other fundamental human rights, like freedom of expression.
So this last resolution, I think, goes further than any of their resolutions have before in terms of rights online. I think you're right. To a large extent, it's a response to the kinds of censorship and the kinds of attacks that we see online by governments. And for that reason, it was a kind of strongly debated resolution, because on the one hand, you have governments that are pushing for greater freedom online. And this particular resolution was led by the government of Sweden. And on the other side, you have governments who see the flow of information as a threat. So in many parts of the world, in times of protest, governments will force telecommunications companies and ISPs, internet service providers, to shut down their services altogether. Or they will filter out information related to the protest, or they'll impose criminal punishment, right? Penalties on individuals or on the big companies for sharing that information. Sometimes they'll shut down text messaging altogether. I mean, we saw this in Egypt, right, in 2011 during the protest in Tahrir Square.
So there's a large protest or a revolt or a coup attempt, and the government decides, okay, it's time to shut down the internet. David says that typically under most circumstances, that is not okay.
Exactly. So can you do something that is less, that is not disproportionate, right? That doesn't, as you say, doesn't affect a broader network of people. These are the kinds of questions that governments, by and large, want to avoid. It's one thing for a state to have the right, in essence, to say, this is a national security issue. But it's up to the court to demand that the government not only justify, but demonstrate that the particular restriction that they've adopted actually achieves that objective.
So the UN now says access to the internet is a human right. Is that accurate to say? And how did that come about?
It's complicated. I hate starting a sentence with "it's complicated."
I mean, this is all very complicated.
I mean, it seems like a cop out. I'm not sure that the UN as a whole is there yet in terms of saying that access to the internet is a right. My guess is that many states would reject that because they would see that as imposing an obligation to provide infrastructure for the internet. And, you know, even if you look at things, you know, basic sustenance, there's pushback against right to water, right to food, right to housing. So when we think of it in those terms, I think it gets complicated for states. However, you know, what Article 19, what international human rights law provides basically, is that everyone has a right to do certain things. So everyone has a right to hold an opinion without interference. That's not subject to any restriction. Everyone has a right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds through any media and regardless of frontiers.
I.e. the internet.
I.e. the internet.
Hello?
Now, to really understand the context behind the passing of this resolution, we should probably go back.
How far back?
Like way back. To 1973, to be exact, the year that Vince Cerf...
I am Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist at Google. That's a relatively unusual title.
The year that he helped create the internet.
Anything on this scale has lots of fathers, but Bob Kahn and I wrote the original protocol design and architecture design way back in 1973. It was published in 1974, and of course we pursued implementation. And it's grown ever since.
The protocol and architecture he's talking about, it's called TCP/IP, and it's made up of two parts, Transmission Control Protocol and Internet Protocol. So if you ever wondered what that means, that's what that means. And those two things are building blocks that make the internet the internet.
Totally. And TCP and IP are the back end of virtually every single thing that we actually use on our computers. Everything from Wi-Fi to Ethernet, LAN, email, 3G, 4G on our phones, the World Wide Web. You've heard of that, right?
Yeah, I think so.
plus all the things that have been invented on top of these inventions.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I heard someone say World Wide Web, but it's a great, great phrase. Vint and his partner Bob Kahn invented those two protocols back in 1973, and they published them in 1974, free for anyone and everyone to use, edit, and build upon. They knew that they'd created something meaningful that could play a huge role in the years to come. And by releasing it for the world to use for free, that was the first active step taken to create a democratic, open, and unrestricted World Wide Web.
There it is again.
Yeah.
Whenever a web page successfully comes up from somewhere on the internet, I'm always astonished and happy that all the pieces that had to work actually worked. The whole idea of networking computers together and allowing them to interact with each other was very enticing. And so a lot of us were motivated by this image of being able to make things happen at a distance that that would be beneficial.
And again, I'm going to go ahead and plead technological ignorance here. I think I understand TCP and IP and all that, but I'm absolutely clueless about how these protocols, these architectures, if you will, those little bits of code actually make the internet work.
Oh, don't worry. I don't get it either. I just pretend that I do. But luckily, he covered that with an amazing metaphor about postcards.
Postcards.
So bear with me. So a postcard, it has a place on it, right, where you can write down a to address. You write down the address of who you are and where you're sending the postcard from. And then there's some places to write some content, your letter.
And that's also true of an internet packet. It's also true that when you put a postcard into the postbox, there's no guarantee it comes out on the other side. This is a best effort system, and that's also true of internet packets. If you put two postcards into the postbox to the same destination, they don't necessarily come out in the same order you put them in. That's also true of internet packets. And in some cases, actually, you get two packets for the one you put in because we may have retransmitted the packet over an alternate route in order to recover from what we thought was a failure.
So really, when it comes down to it, when you think of the internet as a really fast and sophisticated electronic postcard system, you're actually not too far off.
Yeah, exactly.
The system is layered, and so the internet protocol is the postcard part. But then in order to put them all back in order, make sure that things get retransmitted if they were lost, we have another layer of protocol we call Transmission Control Protocol, or TCP. And so you often will hear TCP/IP as a phrase describing the core protocols of the internet. And the TCP part just puts things back in order, retransmits them if they've been lost, makes sure that we don't send too many at a time so we don't lose them at the other end. And so that's basically how the system works. It's a giant, high-speed electronic postcard system.
See, I told you, it's a really good metaphor.
Okay, so now that we're clued up on the basics of Article 19 and the Human Rights Resolution, plus we've dove way down into the history of the internet, it's so cool that we actually got the creator of the internet on the podcast, by the way.
I know, I'm totally nerding out, actually. We have got all that down, but there is something else about the resolution that complicates things. Despite it being associated with Article 19, which is the right to freedom of opinion and expression, at this stage, for a variety of reasons, most countries that voted in favor of the resolution see the resolution only as a kind of recommendation, not a law. David Kaye, again, the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression for the UN, he can explain more about the authority that the resolution maintains.
It requires the High Commissioner for Human Rights to do a report, but it doesn't have any kind of binding quality to it like a human rights treaty might. It isn't new. Like, the ideas in the resolution, even for the Human Rights Council or the General Assembly, are not new. That both of those institutions have passed resolutions over the last several years that say rights offline apply online as well, equally. Like, there's no distinction in terms of the content of those rights. But it hasn't said much more. And even this resolution, although it starts to go down that path, it starts to identify issues around like network shutdowns, things like that we're going to spend a lot of time on over the next year.
So essentially, it doesn't actually put any binding restrictions or anything on a country that doesn't, for instance, provide the fastest 4G internet to its citizens. It won't sanction them or punish them in any way.
Dang, I kind of feel like my provider deserves to be punished, but yeah, no, it does not.
But and there is a but, things do become much stricter when a country actively denies its citizens adequate access to the internet, like we talked about a bit before, because in many cases, by denying someone access to the internet, you're in effect infringing on their basic human rights.
Because in 2016, if the government is, let's say, censoring you or blocking your expression on certain platforms, you're not being allowed to exercise your freedom of opinion to its full potential.
Exactly, and that's where human rights law really comes into play.
Absolutely. And when we come back, we'll talk to a human rights lawyer and dig into the legal implications of a resolution that says, as of July 1st, 2016, internet is a basic human right. Stick with us.
Hi there. If you're enjoying the podcast that you're listening to right now, might I recommend another brilliant show from The Guardian? It's called Science Weekly. And if you're interested in science, you want to hear their analysis, their interviews and reportage, everything from the world of science and technology analyzed by The Guardian's science team. You can find Science Weekly on theguardian.com, iTunes or your podcasting app of choice.
It's Chips with Everything. I'm Lee Alexander, and I'm here with my great producer, Matt Shore.
Hi.
Hey, Matt. And today we are kicking off our four-part series about the internet being considered a basic human right, at least by the United Nations standards. And up until now, it's taken someone who works at the UN, as well as the guy who quite literally helped invent the internet, to just give us a basic understanding of the fundamentals of this UN resolution.
But now we actually have someone on to explain how human rights law plays into the mix.
And who better to do that than a human rights lawyer? His name's
Adam Wagner. I'm a barrister specializing in human rights.
And we met him at his air-conditioned office in central East London on one of the hottest days of the year. When we even say the phrase human right, what exactly does that mean? How is that established for people?
Human rights are an idea that really came into the fore after the Second World War, when the people who had won the war got together and said, how are we going to stop the fascists and the communists coming to power in our countries again or in the future? And they set down a list of basic freedoms which they thought were the cornerstone of a democratic society. So things like the right to privacy, which had been attacked by the secret police in fascist countries, or the right to freedom of religion, which had been attacked by the Nazis. And they wrote down this list and then they put it into an enforceable convention called the European Convention on Human Rights. So anyone in the European area that signed up to the European Convention can go to the court in Strasbourg and enforce their rights.
So would you say that one of the most significant recent developments is that people are using expression online as a tool for political self-expression and for freedom of speech in areas where they might be being oppressed, and that is something that the UN, for example, would want to act on?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that the social media has become the medium for people to join online, to speak online, to arrange protests, to share ideas. And it's been hugely influential in a number of countries which are otherwise oppressive, where people have never really been able to speak up before, particularly where the media is controlled. So that social media, for the first time, has given a large groups in the population a voice. But obviously that is being carefully controlled in certain parts of the world.
So what we're seeing here is the idea that a world where some people have access to this incredibly inexpensive and accessible means of communication and others don't can't be an equitable world.
I think that's right. And I think that democratic societies and free societies will always give people better access to things, to modes of communication, because and modes of publishing, because that's how free societies work. And on the other side of that coin is that the societies which aren't free, it makes sense for all those means of communication to be restricted. So it's a huge part of social interaction and of democratic communication, which is being restricted.
Again, that was Adam Wagner, human rights lawyer and founder of rightsinfo.org.
The internet is a big, complicated beast, right? I mean, on the one hand, it's not hyperbole to say that that the digital age has created the most open, the most accessible forms of access to information that the world has ever seen. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, you carry virtually all the information in the world that you need, if you're in a free society, at least, in your pocket, right? So on that side, it's really been quite amazing and has been something that over the last 10 years, my predecessors and I have really tried to understand and to discuss how the old standards for freedom of speech, freedom of expression, access to information, how those apply in a digital age. You know, it may seem technical and distant and non-binding, but, you know, we're trying to play a long game. And the long game for me is to ensure that the rights that we all should enjoy offline apply in online space.
I guess I come to the conclusion that it's one of the technologies that enables these important human rights. It might be replaced someday by something else. So we shouldn't fall in love with the internet itself, but rather with what it allows us to do. And I certainly think that if you had access to the internet and someone tried to take it away from you, that would be a violation of a human right, because it would be taking away your ability to communicate. And we think that's important.
This was part one of our series about internet access as a human right. We'll be back next week with part two. Here's a little preview.
Yes, I was born in Tallinn. I'm Estonian. I'm an Estonian citizen. But as a foreign minister, but I would also say that in Estonia, every minister, in one sense or another, is an IT minister. Because ICT and cyber is so much linked to our everyday life, business life, private life, so we can't escape and we can't avoid and we don't want to do it.
I had no idea that Estonia was a technological capital of the world.
Yeah, no, neither did I. And that is all coming next week. This episode of Chips with Everything was produced by Matt Shore. Well done, Matt.
Oh, sorry. I was having a sip of my coffee.
That's okay.
Thanks. I tried my best.
Yeah. And we did have some help today on today's production from Katie Callan. Thank you so much, Katie. And if you haven't already, you can subscribe to our podcast on theguardian.com or iTunes. Those links are in the description below. And if you'd like to get in touch with the show, it's guardianchips@gmail.com. Once again, I'm Leigh Alexander, and we'll see you next week for episode two of our series from The Guardian.
Thank you so much. Okay. Bye-bye for now.
The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs.
To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com. Also, subscribe to the Guardian Live podcast. You can do so on iTunes, SoundCloud, and other reputable audio platforms.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.